Islam is a celebratory religion, but the Muslims are not celebratory people.
At all. Why do you think that is?
I think there's something that's happened to our mentality, which has, kind of thrown us off balance, and we don't really celebrate as we ought
in
to.
In what sense?
Nor do we understand what celebration is.
What is this balance that you say we've been thrown off of?
Well, I'll take it back to our dear beloved Sayyid in Lebanon, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, yeah, right? He said in one of his speeches that, I don't know what's wrong with the Muslims. Why are they not celebrating our victories? We've had many victories as a Muslim ummah.
I swear to God.
You know, we just don't celebrate.
I know. Like, you know, when you look at American culture, that, and especially when it's represented in their movies, their movie industry, how they make such a huge hoopla of their veterans.
Yeah.
These people served us. These people protected us. These people fought for us, you know? And we're like, has anyone been through more wars than the Muslims?
Yeah.
Has anyone laid their lives more for their religion and their people, their brothers and sisters, than Muslims?
Yeah,
why aren't we celebrating those people?
As well as that, like, strategic actual victories that we've had. Like, for example, Palestine.
Yeah, the problem with that is, you know, people don't take it as their victory. They don't count them as their victory.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the issues. But I think, to a larger extent, we just don't know how to celebrate.
We don't know
how to be happy anymore.
No, we don't.
We don't know if it's halal to be happy.
We've been so miserable for so long. It's true. We've been so miserable for
there
so long.
There is a thing. Have you heard of inherited phobias?
Yes.
You know, right? People actually inherit fears. Fear is, if you're afraid, you're not going to be happy, right? If we look at the sad side of Islam, which is, you know, Karbala and Muharram, and I'm using the word sad loosely, because actually
it's epic.
See, in media studies, or to a larger extent in English literature, we study a thing called catharsis. Have you heard of catharsis, right? Catharsis is this, like, heightened level of emotional experience where it often leads somebody to tears, and it often happens at the crescendo of a musical piece, or, you know, at that moment where the hero overcomes the villain, he wins at the end, you know, that's your catharsis. That's really what we're experiencing through Karbala.
Exactly. We're so overwhelmed with these passionate emotions, you know?
You know, what did Sayyidah Zainab say? Ma ra'aytu illa jamila. I saw nothing but beauty. Now, I can't remember which scholar it was, but he said that, look, people mistake these tears as tears of
grief.
They are tears of grief, but, you know, tears of guilt, of shame, of, oh no, this happened. No, these are actually tears of, in a weird way, tears of jubilation, tears of, oh my God.
Even. We're celebrating what Abu Abdullah alayhi salam did, what he stood for, what he fought for, what he represents, through mourning for him this way.
See,
no, but celebration is specifically, like, you know, something happy, right?
No, not necessarily.
So if we look at sadness and happiness as being two sides of the same coin, often what happens is somebody experiences some sort of tragedy in their life, and they cover it up. Instead of facing that tragedy, they've just had a loved one who died, for example. Instead of facing it and crying and weeping and mourning, they try and cover it up. And you see that this person goes completely blank. They just ignore it. They block it out. They put it into the back of their mind, into their subconscious. They dump it somewhere. They don't want to face it. What happens to this person? They become depressed, actually. And depression isn't sadness.
Yeah.
It is just a numbness, right? They become numb. They no longer feel anything. Their system just kind of, their emotional structure inside them just shuts off. What they should have done is expressed that sorrow and that sadness, because once you express it, you can then experience happiness.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to reality after a short break, so don't go anywhere. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for joining us again on this show. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio with my special guests. Here are the meanings of celebrate in Oxford Dictionary. Acknowledge a significant or happy day or event with a social gathering or enjoyable activity, or perform a religious ceremony.
The religion has actually given us an infrastructure by which we can express our joy and grief. When we do that, it actually gives us a strange kind of pleasure, which is unique, and only those who weep for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein can know what that pleasure is. And also, it actually paves the way for us to celebrate in a happy sense as well.
Yeah.
But we don't. We just don't. Eid is boring. All right, I'm just going to say this, all right? Eid is boring. When I was a kid, I was growing up, Eid was boring. The only thing that made it remotely interesting is meeting relatives, and maybe they'll give me some money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we definitely should do that. I think we should set a new culture for the new generation. I feel that we should satiate that longing for happiness, celebration, dopamine, serotonin in those children through religious means. Eid al-Ghadir is such a huge deal. And I feel like it should be celebrated even bigger than Christmas, right? And I feel that we should start developing new ideas and new ways for children to feel the significance of this day in the calendar, look forward to it, how much we've been advised to give each other gifts, to visit each other, to feed each other, to wear new clothes, to wear perfume, to look nice for our brothers and sisters.
Smiling.
Jesus Christ is a huge deal, right?
Yeah.
But Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam completes Jesus Christ's mission. This is your sign to do something huge for this Eid al-Ghadir. Did your brother Hassanain have a lot of celebrations growing up? Like religious celebrations?
Yes, indeed. As, say, like Eid al-Adha and Eid al-Fitr, you know, like family gatherings and all. You know, the best part of Eid al-Fitr was we used to collect money from our, you know, relatives and all.
Oh, for sure. And the food, you guys. How are we not talking about the food?
But that was normal for me growing up. You know, every time we got together, we would have nice food. On Christmas, we would have an even better meal because then my uncle would make turkey. You know, so it's in the West, so they get invested into the Western culture. And so Christmas was...
Where did you guys find a halal dhabh turkey?
In the UK? There's loads of Muslim communities in the UK, right?
Yeah, but you guys were for the turkey life? That is so cool.
Yeah, so we used to have a turkey. Come on, Christmas is so cool. We have to give it to the Christians, all right? They did a really good job, all right?
They totally
even
understood
Muslim,
the assignment.
As a Jew, as an atheist, because most people in the UK are atheists anyway. They don't even believe in God, but everybody loves Christmas. You're watching Narnia because it comes on at Christmas time. Right? And Narnia has this Santa Claus figure who comes along and he gives them gifts. But the Chronicles of Narnia is a children's film, fantasy fiction novel, then they adopted it into a movie. But the idea is that Santa Claus just appears randomly and he gives them gifts. He gets a sword, the girl gets a bow, the other girl gets a knife. You know, it was really cool. And Home Alone would come on TV.
Oh,
you didn't
childhood.
Have to go to school.
Childhood.
No school, it's Christmas. It never snowed in the UK, but... You still associate
Christmas.
It never
Christmas. Snowed in the UK?
No, I mean it did, but it was like just sludge. It's never... It's like in the UK, the weather is always miserable from December to December. Like all year round,
it's just
slush. Always... And when it does snow a little bit, you get old ladies slipping over, you get car accidents, like nobody can handle it. So anyway, but we still associate Christmas to snow, you see? They gave it symbology. They gave it a theme. Eid has no theme.
We should do that.
Right,
we
what's the color of
about
Eid?
It.
What's the color of Eid?
Green.
It should be green.
It is.
Do you ever see green stuff anywhere?
Dude, I mean, it depends. Okay, bro. In all fairness, you grew up in a non-Muslim country.
Wait. Christmas has got a theme because it comes that time of year, right?
Yeah.
But Eid doesn't.
It always comes in winter. It always comes in winter.
Two points for Brother Hassanain. Exactly. Christmas always comes, it's associated with that season, but Eid is always, it's constantly shifting, so we can't associate it to a season, but where, a lot of countries like Egypt.
Eid, in some countries, might be associated with, you know, particular food and particular dishes.
Or colors, or symbols. In Egypt, it's all about the lanterns.
Oh, really? That's nice.
And
see, that's
so
nice. That's a theme.
Beautiful. Like Ramadan and Eid in Egypt is like a scene out of a fantasy movie. Narnia ain't got nothing on it,
no
right?
Way.
We have got themes for our Eids. Eid al-Adha, you know, the theme is the sheep.
Christmas.
It's all about
meat. It doesn't have to be a theme to do with a season, but they have a theme. You know, jingle bells. They have a character to represent the whole holiday. Santa Claus, he's this lovely,
happy... Eid al-Adha, what are you forgetting about
sheep?
The goat?
Christmas gets you when you're a kid. When you're an adult, most people are miserable on Christmas,
because
right?
You have to buy gifts for people you see once a year and most probably don't even like. But the point is, like you guys both said, Islam has definitely a lot of celebratory occasions and opportunities for us.
Yeah.
Just for a moment, we're going to go on a break and be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
How can we possibly celebrate if not...
I have a cool idea.
Tell me.
So, we get a palm tree, right?
Yeah.
And we call it the Eid tree.
Ooh.
And then we cover it with lights.
Yes.
And bells.
Palm, because, you know, our religion comes from the... yeah.
Right.
I officially love it.
It's bid'ah.
There's a hadith where Rasulullah says, أَنَا وَعَلِي مِن شَجَرَةٍ وَاحِدَةٍ وَالنَّاسِ مِن شَجَرَةٍ شَتَى. Right?
Me and Ali are from one tree and
yes.
Other human beings are
from other trees. That's that. Well, that's what because the Christmas tree, it's a representation as well, right?
It's
God knows what it represents anymore. It's a great idea.
Halalify it first, put it through this halal filter, then put it into an Islamic filter, and then we'll do it.
So let's do it some other way. I firmly believe, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying copy the Christians or the Hindus or the Buddhists or the Jews, though I think 8 days of celebration would do very much good for my mental health. I'm saying that what we already have within our ahadith, our narrations, our mustahabbat, the ethics of celebration, just put those to practice for crying out loud, and we're going to be a happy bunch.
But what are they?
Giving gifts,
That's
already being followed that much.
I'm saying there needs to be some sort of visual. There has to be something visual. There has to be a theme associated with Eid, otherwise we're not going to sell it to children.
Well, create a theme.
What's
the
theme?
This is a theme.
Yeah,
like
I think maybe, honestly, seriously, we need to get together as a...
A thinking tank.
Thinking tank. And then come up with what we're going to do. How are we going to present it? Every Eid is different and it has its
own. And we can have, like, you know, how they have that thingy? We can have a reenactment of that scene of Ghadir.
Ah, a reenactment. Yeah. That's such a good idea, yeah.
And
yeah.
We could have school plays.
It's school plays.
Right?
Yeah,
we could have little, like, silhouettes put beside somewhere when the child sees and then, like, Mama, what is that? And I get to explain to them the story of Ghadir.
You are inspiring me way too much right now.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him. And he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
السيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We were looking at human rights from the scope and the ideology of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We were talking about how he valued the human life to the extent that when he wrote his covenant to Malik al-Ashtar, he gave him a set of instructions that he needs to deal with people. I want to look at part of it. And he says, he who takes the blood of a person and sheds the blood of a person, and he talks about the afterlife, obviously, he says, وَاللَّهُ سُبْحَانَهُ وَتَعَالَى مُبْتَدِئٌ بِالْحُكْمِ بَيْنَ الْعِبَادِ. When it comes to Allah on Day of Judgment, the first thing Allah will judge upon, or the first thing, or the first law or order of law in the court of God will be what? He says, فِيمَا تَسَافَكُوا مِنَ الدِّمَاءِ. When it comes to them and the bloodshed that they've done. So anyone who has taken the blood of another human being or the life of another human being, he will be the first or among the first in line to be judged. And then he says, فَلَا تَقَوْيَنَّ سُلْطَانَكَ بِسَدْكِ دَمٍ حَرَامٍ. Do not enforce your rule by trying to shed blood. فَإِنَّ ذَلِكَ مِمَّا يَضْعُفُهُ. For that, it will actually weaken it. وَيُهَنَهُ. And it will humiliate such a system. Any system, any dictatorship system that's that past and that even current. When you look at them, first, they are weak. They're not strong for shedding the blood of innocent people. And everyone looks down on them. We don't look at Hitler, for example, or Mussolini and all these bloodbaths. And even today, when you look at our current bloodbath leaders, like, you know, the Americans, for example, the American system, the American presidents, and the Jews, for example, and even some of the Arab leaders who shed the blood of innocent people, that doesn't make them stronger. It makes them weaker and actually humiliates them. And when it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they will get the punishment. Well, from this itself, from this passage in the covenant to Michael Ashtar, we learn a few things. One, the emphasis on the fact that shedding blood is forbidden, and not just the blood of a Muslim, because the context of the letter or the covenant is general. Safku dima is general. He did not say safku dima al-Muslimin. He did not specify. So it applies to everybody. So the right of life is guaranteed for all, not just the Muslims. One. Two, when it comes to the ruler himself, he's not exempted. Doesn't mean he can kill his servants or kill his subjects or kill the people under him or his citizens. He is not exempted. If a ruler or a king or a president, whoever he might be, if he commits a crime, if he kills a person, takes the life of a person, he needs to be punished. His life needs to be taken as a result. So he kind of, Amir al-Mu'mineen in this passage, he equalized between that which is governing and he who is governed. So the governor and the governed are they both the same when it comes to applying the laws in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Let us take a break, then we continue inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at the letter or the covenant that Amir al-Mu'mineen wrote to his companion Malik al-Ashtar as he was sending him as a governor to Egypt. And also among the things that we can derive from this letter is the fact that shedding blood, it's always a calamity that befalls on a nation. It's always something that brings the wrath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not only the wrath of Allah, but the wrath of people and the wrath of other nations. In fact, it will lead to people being divided from within. It creates a sense of pollution. It pollutes the environment and the society that people live in. And even Amir al-Mu'min salamullah alayhi, and because this would lead to trying to get revenge yourself if someone kills for you, also if we kill someone, obviously he would have family and, you know, people that wouldn't want to take revenge from me. So it will create a very unstable society. For that, Amir al-Mu'min salamullah alayhi says, لِكُلِّ دَمٍ ثَائِرٍ, for every blood that spilled, for every life that's taken, there's someone that will stand up for that blood. Back in the day, wars used to rage for months and months and years because one person from another tribe killed another person from another tribe. And we even have it here where if, for example, one citizen of a country gets killed, the other country retaliates and they, you know, start to bombard the other country. And we saw that in our recent history happening. So every blood, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, it has a tha'ir, someone that will take the revenge for it. وَلِكُلِّ حَقٍ طَالِبٍ, for every right, there's someone that seeks it. Someone will seek his right. If you take the right of other people, they will become an asking for it. Now, this whole concept of people taking revenge or people seeking their rights, it means there's a collision, there's a problem between people themselves that led them to this notion of trying to get the rights from others and others depriving them of their rights. Or a person is asking to shed a life or the blood of another person and take their life as in a way to take revenge for the life that was taken from them. And so on and so forth. Therefore, the Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, we see that even when it comes to people who incite hatred and incite the notion of killing to others, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi used to punish them. We'll leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking. The rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking? And yeah. That done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly, and you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has and what really is its strength is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that. The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, that It was very bitty, but that's its nature, and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, and they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? But maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes, actually, which I guess if it were a real protest, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learn that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? Absolutely. And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own message across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images. And tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of it, I mean, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policeman liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing. And that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way your authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, trying to converse with the police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
Yeah.
And I'd like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. Or, you know, I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, you know, that they, one of their fellow citizens, and I think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest or versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, you know, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest, and sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, you know, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, yeah, violence, of course this should happen. It said, well, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and you know, they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovica, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Marius, what about, what did you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, you know, changing the mayor and, you know, removing the radar cameras.
Some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that you know, they, as the woman was saying there, they'd replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially in a time like now, this political climate, where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor and no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation, and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. After speaking about the political system and the Islamic approach to how a society needs to be governed, and how us as citizens of a society need to follow the authority that is placed upon us, as long as that authority has certain qualities. And these, of course, clear, obvious qualities and features, the most important of them needs to be them being just. Continuing on with this topic, we can understand that there are certain instructions in Islam, teachings in Islam, that explain to us how we need to follow the social system and create a better society among us, especially when it comes to keeping that level of unity, which is the first and foremost important lesson for us to learn, that jama'ah, congregation, uniting with congregation, being involved in a community is of utmost importance. And we can see how much recommendation there is in participating in Salatul Jumu'ah. Why is it that in each occasion there is around us, there's always that encouragement of us being involved with those who are around us? So not only with Salatul Jama'ah, but especially with Jum'ah and Eid and other occasions. When there's a marriage, when there's a Fatiha, the most recommended thing is for you to be involving others in your program that you have. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi has a wonderful hadith where he mentions what is the benefit of us being with jama'ah, with congregation, with a community, and not to isolate ourselves. He says, "Inna shaytana dhi'bul insan." Shaytan is a human's wolf, is the wolf of the human being. Inna shaytana dhi'bul insan ka dhi'bil ghanab, similar to the wolf of a herd of sheep. Ya'khudhu ash-shat al-qasiyah wal-nahiyah, the wolf
attacks the lone sheep, the sheep who is isolated by itself. The wolf sees that to be vulnerable prey and goes for it. فَإِيَّاكُمْ وَالْشِعَابِ So stay away, be careful, avoid any kind of dispersing, of separation. إِيَّاكُمْ وَالْشِعَابِ وَعَلَيْكُمْ بِالْجَمَاعَةِ And make sure that you stay with a group, stay apart, be a part of a community.
وَعَلَيْكُمْ بِالْجَمَاعَةِ وَالْعَامَّةِ وَالْمَسْجِدِ
Be a part of a group, be a part of the public, and be a part of the masjid. What a beautiful hadith. You know, we can see this. A person who does isolate themselves, a person who secludes themselves from the rest of the Muslims, yes, they might have less of a headache. Yes, they might, you know, want to avoid dramas and things like that. But at the same time, there's going to be their susceptible ways of falling into the snare of shaitan.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرم نماز قصاب داره فرم روزو هم
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرم درخت کاری اینجا کم قصاب داره دعا هم داره سبا هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینا همون امام گفته دیگه
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, talking about how we need to stay united. And although with all the benefits of unity and having compassion and loving one another as fellow Muslim brothers and sisters, with that brotherhood system that we need to have, that sisterhood network that we need to have, anything that is going to damage that is something that we need to condemn, especially when it comes to severing ties with your fellow brother or sister, or when it comes to issues like not involving yourself with everyone else or anything else. And that's why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, لا يزال إبليس فرحاً مهتجر المسلمان. Iblis will continue to stay happy as long as two Muslims are avoiding each other, are upset with each other, and they have cut ties with each other. مَا هَتَجَرَ الْمُسْلِمَانِ فَإِذَا إِلْتَقَيَا اصْطَكَّتْ رُكْبَتَهُ وَتَخَلَّعَتْ أَوْصَالُهُ وَيْنَادَى يَا وَيْلَهُ مَا لَقِيَ مِنَ الْثُبُورِ Basically, when these two Muslim brothers, these two Muslim sisters, who have been upset for a while, when they join back together, when they reconcile, shaitan is going to go, basically going to go crazy. He is going to wreak havoc, and he's going to be extremely, extremely upset, which is exactly why, I'm going to be speaking about this in the next episodes, but that's exactly why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he said, إصلاح ذات البين, for you to reconcile, for you to be involved in reconciling between two people. أفضلوا من عامة الصلاة والصوم. It is better than all prayer and fasting. Just bringing together two people. We'll continue on with this topic in our next episode. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and